Right now, it is time to bring in Arthur Schwartz, and Arthur talks about food with us every Monday at this time. Good morning, Arthur. How are you today?
I'm fine. I went off my diet.
Well, there you go. You have your pasta?
You know, it's a year. I have been eating ketogenically for a year, and there are a number of things. It's interesting. I was talking to a friend in Rome the other day, and her husband, Roberto, my friend also, was dieting and lost a lot of weight also. And it's interesting. He's a Roman. And Anne was saying he doesn't miss pasta. He misses bread, but he's eating it. So that's why he's gaining back his weight. But in any case, I had to go off because I had been craving chocolate cake, which is totally forbidden. Anyway, I'm looking through a book. Let me start at the beginning here, how I happened across this recipe and had to make it. I was looking for a book. I'm going to talk about this some other time. But I was looking all over for a book that I couldn't imagine I gave away. And sure enough, it was in storage in a box ready to be given away. And fortunately, it wasn't. It's called A Bowl of Red, and it's a history of chili, as you've heard before. I'm really totally into chili lately. Anyway, I'm looking for this book, and I was looking for something else, and I found that book, The Bowl of Red, and along with it, a book called Food Editor's Hometown Favorites Cookbook, American Regional and Local Specialties. This is a follow-up book, also by food editors all around the country. And it was all to benefit the newspaper Food Editors and Writers Association, which I thought I was a member of, but this book, published in the early 80s, well, let me say, I went to work at the Daily News as the executive food editor in 1979, and I have to look and see what the original book was published, probably around 1980 or so, and I would not have been at the Daily News when they needed somebody from the Daily News to contribute to the book. So when it came to the follow-up book, they went to the person that they, I'm sure, went to at first, Carol Brock. Carol Brock was at the Daily News before I was, but I was hired as her editor over her, as well, also over some other people. And that's why they called me executive food editor. So anyway, Carol, who died last year, age 94, I believe, I was very happy. I had lunch with her just before she, well, within the 6 months before she died. And she was in great shape, let me say. This woman took care of herself. She exercised. And at 93, when I saw her last, she was in really great shape, mentally as well. Well, let me say, if Carol was ever good mentally, Carol's way of seeing the world was visually. How she became a food writer at the Daily News is a long story. But when I got there, I had this wonderful woman, great visually, great at setting up a photo shoot and many other things, but not a writer. So I know that this recipe, Head Note, was not written by Carol Brock. And it does claim that this chocolate cake, which is called a brownstone front cake, is supposedly is the ultimate city recipe, and it's supposed to resemble, as this head note says, it's supposed to resemble the slabs of brownstones that have come to characterize a romantic version of little old New York. Well, I suppose I live in that romantic version of little old New York. My neighborhood is almost all brown. Well, if it's not brownstones, they're brick mansions, or they're limestone townhouses, and they were all built at the end of the 19th century, the very, very beginning of the 20th century, but mainly in the 19th century. And so I live in a neighborhood that this cake is supposed to resemble, and it has no resemblance whatsoever. It's a chocolate pound cake baked in a loaf pan. Well, I would say it's a pound cake, baked in a loaf pan, and then glazed with a chocolate glaze. Now, Carol was very good at recipes, at developing and writing recipes. She didn't need that much editing, actual editing, in her recipe writing, but she could not write head notes. She could not write prose. So I know she didn't write that. So, and I don't know where this came from, but I since I'm sort of a new, not sort of, I am officially a New York City food historian, and I never, ever heard of brownstone front cake until I opened up this little spiral-bound food editor's book. I thought I had to do this. I had to see what this was all about. And it really is a sort of weirdo recipe, which made it even more intriguing. So I let me say that Carol's instructions are 95% correct. The only problem with this cake, in the end, was the chocolate frosting, or a glaze, as she also puts it, was too much for this cake. We had a lot of extra. It was way more. I would say it was double the amount of glaze you needed to glaze this this loaf cake, 9x5x3-inch loaf cake. So we said, of course, I used the sauce, and since I'm on a diet, and I knew if the whole cake stayed in the house, we would end up eating it. I gave 2/3 of it to my next-door neighbor, who really does need to gain weight. Her doctor even told her, you have to gain weight. So she got 2/3 of it and a lot of the glaze, and we both decided that a scoop of ice cream on this cake with the extra glaze poured over it would be divine. If you want to add some whipped cream, too, that would be even diviner. But it's a very, very good pound cake. And you could make it without the glaze altogether. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily dust it with confectioner's sugar, but you could. It's just good the way it is. So here it is. Very easy recipe, but a little strange. 2 cups of unsifted all-purpose flour. Now, we were very meticulous about this at the Daily News. The way to measure flour, and so all our recipes, the flour was measured this way and really gives you the accurate measure, is you spoon the flour into a cup and level it off without tamping it down, without pressing it down, and without scooping it, because that compresses it also. So 2 cups of unsifted all-purpose flour, which was spooned into a cup. Mix into that 1 teaspoon of baking soda. It's the only leavening in this recipe, which is one of the things that intrigued me. And that the recipe calls for 1/8 teaspoon of salt. I would actually use 1/2 teaspoon of salt. I am going to make, this is my excuse, to make this cake again. I really want to try it with way more salt, because our tastes have changed in the last 30 years, 40 years, even 20 years, and we expect a little salty undertone in even our sweet baked goods. And I learned this at least 20 years ago from a friend who was the head of a test kitchen. And I gave her a recipe to test for me. I think it was a recipe in New York City food. And I said, you know, could you just try this out in your test kitchen? And she came back to me. She said, it's a terrific recipe, except you have to increase the salt a lot. So, and I realize our tastes have changed, and we expect that now. So I would add 1/2 teaspoon of salt. And you mix those 3 dry ingredients together, the flour, the baking soda, the salt. Now, here's another technique that nobody uses anymore, but Carol has you put 2 squares, 1 ounce each, of unsweetened chocolate in a small bowl, and then pour over 1 cup of boiling water and just let it sit. Of course, the chocolate's going to melt, and eventually you're going to stir it together. Do that and set that aside. Now, you need 1 full stick of butter, 1/2 cup of butter, should be more or less room temperature, and softened anyway, and beat it, I use my handheld mixer, until it's all fluffed. And then gradually add 1 3/4 cup of firmly packed light brown sugar. I added like maybe 1/4 cup at a time. And once that got incorporated, I added another quarter of a cup in time, you know, like that. Just keep beating. Now, this is why I think this cake leavens so well. Because in the old-fashioned pound cakes, I mean 19th-century pound cakes, the original pound cakes, English pound cakes, there was no leavening. It was all done by beating, beating, beating. And this cake gets beaten quite a lot. So gradually add 1 3/4 cups of light brown sugar into 1/2 cup of creamed butter. All mixed together well. Add 2 eggs. Carol tells you to beat them ahead of time, and that's a good technique, but you don't need to. I added 1 egg. I beat it through until it was incorporated. I beat in another egg, and I beat that again. And then you add alternately your mixed dry ingredients, that's the flour, baking soda, and salt, alternately with 1/2 cup of sour cream. Now, that's the ingredient that's going to make the cake rise a little bit. Baking soda is alkaline. Sour cream is acid. And, by the way, chocolate also has some acidity. So the combination of the baking soda and the acid sour cream and chocolate is what makes this cake leaven. And it does leaven. It does really rise a lot. So you want to add the flour and the add a little flour, add a few tablespoons of sour cream, add more flour, like that. Start and end with the flour. Carol calls for a teaspoon of vanilla extract, which you beat in with the chocolate. So now that you have all this mixed, you then add you mix the chocolate and water together, melted by then, and add that chocolate liquid to the batter, along with at least a teaspoon of vanilla. You can be a little generous with that. I found that depends on the chocolate you're using too. But I was using Guitar, unsweetened chocolate, and I found that it needs a little extra vanilla. And that's it. Pour that into a 9 by 5 by 3 inch loaf pan, greased and floured. And it gets, now Carol's instruction was to bake it at 325, which is a low temperature for a cake, for 50 to 60 minutes. I checked my cake at 55 minutes by inserting a cake tester, and it was not done. I then got scared and turned the oven up to 350 and baked it another 10 minutes. So altogether it was in the oven 65 minutes, but the last 10 were at 350. Although, of course, it takes a little time for it to get back up to 325 even after you've opened the oven. So anyway, you want to check this with the cake tester, and the tester should come out clean from the center of the cake. Let it cool in the pan for at least 10-15 minutes. Turn it out and let it cool thoroughly, and then do what you want with it. If you want to know about this chocolate frosting, it's real easy. I would make it again, but it's too. Carol has using again another 2 ounces of chocolate, and 2 tablespoons of butter, and a little vanilla extract, like a 1/2 teaspoon. Depends, as I say, on the chocolate. And you beat together the butter, the vanilla, and again salt, about 1/4 teaspoon of salt, and then beat in 1 cup of confectioner's sugar, and then 1 egg, and 1/4 cup of milk. It will be a very liquidy chocolate glaze. Spoon it over the cooled cake. Let it seep into any cracks that are on the top, which there will be, beautiful cracks, and let it drip down the sides and like that, and then let it cool altogether because it does get a little firmer as it cools. You could probably put a second layer on, but I thought that was being too much indulgence for me. A really good cake. Now, and may Carol rest in peace. She had a very, very full life. She worked until the end in the 90s. She was the founder of a very important culinary organization called Les Dames d'Escoffier. And joke between us was, she had founded this organization just before I got to the Daily News. And it involved quite a lot of work. And Carol was a very diligent worker, got to say. And a lot of the time she spent on Les Dames, so I got to calling it Les Broads, of course, totally not politically correct anymore, but wasn't even then. That was 30-something years ago. So I've been cooking and cooking and cooking. You know, I haven't stopped cooking. The cake was a total indulgence. But last week, as I was, I was getting off the air.
You said you were going to go and have some pasta.
Well, this is the thing. I am going to eat some pasta this week. And what I mentioned is how easy it can be for a food writer slash editor, because there's always a new food season to talk about and write about and find recipes for. And I said, well, you know, like last week we talked about red peppers. Or was it tomatoes? Tomatoes the last week. And I said, oh, you know, like we're getting to be the winter squash season. Well, no sooner had I said that than a friend who was in Italy for weeks and weeks, I was so jealous, and he was in Cilento, which is the region, it's the area of Salerno, just behind Cecilia's farm in Pestum, are mountains, and that's the Cilento. We could say Pestum is the gate to Cilento. Anyway, they were up in Cilento, and his final meal in Cilento was exactly the thing I was craving, which is, I don't like cavatelli so much, but he was eating cavatelli with a dressing of sausage and butternut squash. And that's something I used to make all, well, I say used to only because I'm not eating pasta so much now. I could actually take the same base of sausage and butternut squash, I'll tell you how to make that in a sec, and make a soup out of it. Just thought of that at the moment. I mean, it doesn't have to be on pasta, although I love it, this sauce, chunky sauce, on a pasta called paccheri. Paccheri are the largest tubes. It's actually a Neapolitan dialect word, and they're enormous tubes. And usually you eat things that get, you know, you want to get caught up into these tubes. They're almost like, you know, as heavy as a lasagna noodle, so you can't eat too many of them. So maybe that's a good thing for me to eat, because I could only eat three or four. So here, this is the sauce for cavatelli, for paccheri, rigatoni. You want something other than cavatelli. You want a pasta, I think, that catches some of this sauce. It's not really a liquid sauce. It's a chunked-up sauce. Oh, by the way, the real word for paccheri is, as I said, a Neapolitan dialect word. And it's related to, you're going to love this, Marshall, because you probably got them when you were a kid, a pachintuchis in Yiddish, a slap on the ass.
Oh, yeah,
A pachintuchis.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the word paccheri means slaps in Neapolitan dialect. And the dialect word comes from Austrian, because they were controlled by the Austrians for a couple hundred years. No, really more than that. But the Italian word for this pasta, because you may see it in a store and be interested, it's called schiaffone. Schiaffone, S-C-H-I-A-F-F, schiaffone. Zitoni is another good pasta for this. So here's how you do it. In really a mere tablespoon or so, listen, I make this without pancetta, but in one of my cookbooks, I guess this may be in Southern Italian, I call for an optional pancetta. I only do that because the woman I learned this recipe from used pancetta too much, and so I felt obliged to at least say that she had a little pancetta in the recipe. But you can do this without pancetta. You just need two links of sweet Italian pork sausage, preferably without fennel. It's about a half a pound of sausage, and I slit them and remove the sausage meat from the sausage casings, throw away the casings. If, by the way, you have a butcher or a supermarket that sells, you know, loose Italian sausage out of the casings, which I do, you can buy a half a pound. So in a tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil, I want you to sauté this half pound of sweet Italian sausage meat until it loses its raw look, you know, no longer pink. Doesn't have to be brown. In fact, you don't want it brown. And then you add, I would say, you know, a half a cup of finely minced onion, of this probably the smallest onion you have in your bin, or no more than a half of a medium onion, minced, meaning small, and then a clove of garlic, could be coarsely chopped, finely chopped, throw that in with the meat, and a tablespoon chopped of fresh rosemary leaves. If you don't have fresh rosemary, you definitely can use crumbled, dried rosemary. I do all the time. Right now, I'm actually drying some. I found beautiful rosemary from practically nothing. So, and my thought was to make this, and then my also thought was I can hang this in the kitchen and it dries beautifully. So, and if you like hot pepper, this is a good moment for it. About a quarter of a teaspoon of hot red pepper flakes. So, put that all in the pot with the sausage, and then add your squash. Now, the squash is, I use butternut squash, but you could use any squash, really. A cheese pumpkin, too. By the way, I already am getting sick of pumpkin. All the stores around here are already decorated with pumpkins. I don't know. To me, a pumpkin's decoration more than to eat. But there are good pumpkins called cheese pumpkin. Anyway, you want it peeled, of course, and cut into half-inch cubes. More or less cubes, you know, they're not really cubes. Excuse me, pieces. And then all together you'll have 4.5 to 5 cups of squash. Put that in the pot with the sausage. Turn it around a little bit. Salt and pepper. Well, you may not need pepper. It depends on your, you know, we're adding hot red pepper flakes. So forget the pepper. Salt, though. You definitely need a good teaspoon of salt. And 2 cups of water. Now, here's something important. I do this in a pot that when I put in my 2 cups of water, it just covers the solid ingredients, meaning the squash and sausage mainly. And that's what you want. So pour in your water. Figure you're going to need about 2 cups, but it definitely will depend on the size pot you're using. And I use a 3-quart saucepan, not a 2.5-quart saucepan for this. And you want everything just covered with water. And let it simmer. It depends on how you cut the squash, and it depends on everything. But figure 20 minutes to a half an hour. What you want is the squash to become soft enough that you can literally squash it. Smash the squash onto the side of the pot with the back of your wooden spoon to get a chunky puree. You do not want to put this in the food processor. You don't want to. You could use a potato masher if you have the kind that's the wire kind of potato masher. But you want, what you want here is a chunky puree of squash seasoned with all that wonderful sausage and onion and garlic and rosemary. And that, I happen to have some really good broth that I made. Maybe I'll just make this into soup and forget the pasta. Or I could add a little bit of pasta at the end, make it a soup with pasta in it. That, this way you eat a smaller amount of pasta. So, and it doesn't have to be a tubular then. It could be orzo even. It could be some small pasta. Ditalini would be nice for soup.
So you still haven't given in yet then to pasta yet?
No, I haven't. I did eat ice cream yesterday, but I have to report it wasn't worth it. I went to a Thai. You know, you get to the point where, like, if you're going to eat these forbidden starches, yeah. Basically, yeah, they better be good. Ice cream is sugar. You know, I went to a Thai restaurant. We haven't been out to eat hardly at all. Maybe not since June, when it seemed safer. Now it seems very safe, actually, because as you may have heard on the news, COVID proof is vaccination proof is required to enter a restaurant here. And they did, in fact, in this little neighborhood Thai place, they did, in fact, check us. So, you know, I don't see what the big deal is. You know, restaurants and bars have had to check IDs for age forever. I mean, as long as I can remember, which was before I was legal. So that's a long time ago. In the days when you had to have a fake ID to get into a bar, if you were 17, you know. I went to the racetrack when I was 17. That was also not allowed. You had to be 18 unless you were with an adult. But they did check at the racetrack. Now that I'm thinking, I don't know how I had a fake ID. That's how I got away with it. Anyway, yeah. So we went to the Thai restaurant, and I ate some very keto-friendly food, and then had to indulge in some coconut ice cream. But I know where to get better coconut ice cream next time. Anyway, I'm going to make steak Diane today. And when was the last time you ate steak Diane?
I can't remember.
It's exactly. It's totally non-existent now. But even in 25 years ago, 20 years ago, at 21, they still made steak Diane. It was a real restaurant, fancy restaurant, a dish in the 1930s, 40s, 50s even, and then it sort of faded out. But on TV the other day, I saw somebody making steak, a new way with steak Diane. But I like the old way fine enough, which is, the reason I'm making it is I was able to buy some tenderloin tips, meaning tornado, the narrow end of the filet mignon. Actually, the filet mignon is the middle prime section of it. Anyway, these were really a good buy, and I thought, let me do something with these. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to sear them in a blazingly hot cast iron skillet, and in a little bit of, and I'm not going to add butter at the beginning because the butter will burn my skillet. But I do want the meat to get browned, and then I'm going to add some, lower the heat all the way. The pan will retain the heat for a while. And add a couple tablespoons of butter, several tablespoons of chopped shallots, minced shallots. Let that cook for just a minute or two. I haven't decided yet if I was going to put any garlic in there, but I might put in a tiny, like a half a clove of garlic minced. And then you deglaze the pan with a mixture of, well, first cognac. Then I can splash some, let's say, a quarter cup of cognac in there, which probably will go up in flames. And then I'm going to add my liquid, which is about a half a cup of broth. And I do have good chicken broth, but I think I actually have some beef in the freezer, too. Beef broth is preferred with the beef dish, of course. About a half a cup of broth mixed with, I would say, a tablespoon of Worcestershire sauce. And I would say also a nice heaping teaspoon of Dijon mustard and cream. And I would say 2 or 3 tablespoons of heavy cream. Pour that into the pan. Let it cook down a couple minutes. Put your meat back in the sauce. Turn it in the sauce a little bit. Put it on a plate and garnish it with chives. This summer I have been dill crazy, but I've also become chive crazy. I've mentioned chives a lot.
Well, that must have been sounded good.
Well, the steak Diane is in my book, New York City Food, and it's more of a story there than I just told. I do remember eating it. It was funny at the end of 21 is closed very sadly. I mean, that's my saddest restaurant closing. So it's such an iconic place for me anyway. It was not a club. They always called it the 21 Club, but it was not a club. The only club is if you could afford to go there, you were in the club. So, and a lot of big-time, CEOs, executives used to frequent the bar room there, which was hung with executive toys, I used to call them. Toy planes representing, because like the CEO of TWA ate there, so his plane was from the ceiling. Anyway, the funny thing, at the end, even at 21, sort of nobody wanted to eat this dish. I don't know why. It's very good. And it was made at the table side so that they could flambé and put on a show. But they would only do it if the place was half empty because the waiters didn't really have time to do this table side thing. Also, Caesar salad there was a tableside event, too. Whenever they could do anything tableside at 21, they did it, because it was a show. And it was a show. So, steak Diane today, not squash and cavatelli. I am going to make this, and I am going to try making it as a soup. Because it's really the so. I mean, the pasta is just a foil.
Yeah.
After all, I'm not missing. You know, as I said, my friend Roberto in Rome. He's not missing pasta as much as bread.
I've given up on bread, but basically, except some whole wheat stuff that imitates
well,
bread.
Well, you know, I did that when I was. I'm getting all blood tested next week, and we'll see what's going on here. But I have not lost weight in at least 2 months. I do believe all my other numbers are great. I just have a feeling, and I mean, how bad could they be? I don't eat more than 50 carbohydrates a day. And by the way, this diet has reduced my arthritis inflammation. The first place you feel arthritis, I've learned, is in your basal thumb joint. So if anybody out there has basal thumb joint pain, it's likely arthritis. And since I've been eating like this for a year, I have almost no basal joint arthritic pain. And also, my physical therapist and I have decided that I don't really have much arthritic knee pain, that my knee problems are strictly sciatica, no longer sciatica plus arthritis. So the diet does good things, but it's really, at this point, after a year, I do allow myself one day of indulgence. And I think that's the way it's going to be.
Okay. All right.
Forever.
All right.
All right, Marshall, we need to talk, so call me off-air one of these days.
I will.
Okay?
I also gave Jill all the other information, too, as well. So but between the two of us, we'll beat you to death.
Well, I have other things to discuss.
Okay.
I need you off the air.
Okay. All right.
Take care. Have a great week, everyone.
All right. That is Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, here on The Breakfast Club on Robin Hood Radio.
Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467, on the web, jarestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Groceries on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, rubiners.com. Hillsdale Home Chef, more information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.